I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and it's my enormous pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. This is our last lecture of the fall 2016 season, and that is thanks to our first focus show for the 2016-2017 season. Artist Lorna Simpson is showing original works in Focus Lorna Simpson, which is curated by the Modern's Allison Hurst and is opening this weekend. As an extension of the exhibition and a bit of a preview, Lorna has generously agreed to close our fall Tuesday evening season with this lecture. From what I've seen of the paintings in Gallery 7, on the second floor is going to be an absolutely stunning and I think particularly pertinent exhibition. And from what I know of Lorna Simpson's past work and her career, I think tonight holds the very same promise. Born and currently based in Brooklyn, Lorna received a BFA in photography from the School of Visual Arts and an MFA in visual arts from UC San Diego. She has exhibited extensively, both nationally and internationally, including exhibitions at the Brooklyn Museum, Walker Art Center, Studio Museum in Harlem, LA MoCA, MoMA, New York, PS1, and the Whitney Museum of American Art. Most recently, there was a solo exhibition of Lorna's work at her New York gallery, Salon 94 in the Bowery. And along with an extensive list of recent group exhibitions, I wanted to mention that her work was included in the Whitney 2015 inaugural exhibition, America is Hard to See. And I believe some of you may have seen that exhibition, so I wanted to pull that out of the resume in particular. Lorna was, I find this very hard to believe, but it's in our press release, so I believe it. Lorna was the first African-American woman to be included in the Venice Biennale with the 44th Biennale in 1990, participating in a number of important international exhibitions, including Documenta 8 and 11, as well as the 56th Venice Biennale in 2015. In 2013, a retrospective of Lorna's work began in Paris at the Jeu des Paumes before traveling to the Haus der Kunst in Munich, the Baltic Center of Contemporary Art in Gateshead in the UK, and Addison Gallery of American Art at Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. So she has been quite busy, and in one of the interviews that I read, she said she was very happy in 2015 to be able to get back into her studio. And I think we're going to see the result of that in our exhibition. We are incredibly fortunate to have Lorna's work here at the Modern, and our good fortune is doubled with tonight's lecture. So please join me in welcoming Lorna Simpson.
Good evening. It's such a nice welcoming. I have never been to Dallas before. I've been to Austin. It's my first time being in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So thank you for welcoming me and such a lovely welcome. I thought that in doing this and kind of the opportunity of having a focus show, which is of new work, and that I branched off in terms of the past few years of going into painting and saying, yes, I want to do a show of new works aside from doing commercial gallery shows of painting for here in this institution was quite an opportunity. And came from this year of a body of work, and is the culmination of a body of work. So it's interesting for me because in terms of giving lectures, in some ways, I'm a little bit hesitant to talk about, as an artist, as a new work, because you kind of feel like it's new, it's, I don't know what to talk about, it's really personal, it's very new in that way, even to me in terms of the way I might interpret it or even look back at it. But I'm going to kind of jump through a whole series of works to talk about how I got here. So, in starting, my love, my start, I mean, I started as a painter in undergraduate school, but my love and start is really photography. And the arena that I kind of walked into or became recognized as an artist is kind of these photographic works of large-scale studio works that kind of interrogated the way the viewer thinks about photography, unpacks it, who's the author, who is the subject in the photograph, combined with these kind of images of photos and texts. And this is Water Bearer from 1986, which is a very early piece that I did just getting out of, kind of moving back to New York and getting out of graduate school. And I have to say, going to graduate school in San Diego was quite amazing and at the same time very isolated in terms of the way that my work was viewed. But as a kind of fellow graduate student, I felt very isolated and that I was in my own world and came up with work. So it was kind of as though I made this work in a vacuum, a very little understanding or conversation, and then went back to New York and like got all this attention. And it was it's a very strange thing as a young person to kind of experience that. But I felt that I was returning to New York to an enclave of people who understood in terms of curators, artists, filmmakers, and performers who were all after the same thing, which is this, we're just going to do what we do. And it wasn't this idea that in terms of the art market as we look at it now, that you have this idea that you're going to make a lot of money and you're going to have a career. There was none of that. It was more you have this opportunity just to carve out what it is you want to do, and you do that. So Water Bearer is one piece. And when I got out of graduate school, I got this job at Broader Museum as a secretary for Joan Simon, who later became the curator for the show at the Jeu de Paume in Paris. But while I was working for her as a secretary out of graduate school through Kelly Jones, who's an art historian, who was there as a curator, I would take the keys from Kelly that night, because it was like a loft space in Soho, and photograph and make work at night. So I was very much about, like, I got a day job. That day job has to work for me as an artist. And I had all these kind of short-term jobs or jobs that I felt that I wanted a job that I didn't have to commit to, because I was more committed to my work, so I could just get the money and go. So I had this kind of series of jobs as an artist, in this realm of people. It would be a struggle to work for Sandoz, which is like this pharmaceutical company, corporate pharmaceutical company on Fifth Avenue. And then by the time I left, they were like giving me watches, like as though I'd been there for 50 years. And they're like, oh, we're so sorry to see you go. And I was like, but you're going to fire me, because I couldn't understand the difference between Breuer, Brewer, and Broy on the phone, between, you know, kind of accents and all that. But it's a different time than it is now, certainly, in so many different ways in terms of economics and politics, etc. But I was very committed to just find a job that you can get and just do the work you're going to do and wear the stockings and go in and try to pronunciate the names correctly for a certain amount of time and then quit and then save that money and make work. And kind of that work is what followed. Stereo style. So I worked in the 20 by 24 Polaroid studio of making photographs there with a model and friend and performance artist named Alfred Rogers. And we would trade, like she would pose for me, I would pay her, but also give her images for her performances in terms of headshots and stuff. And this is stereo style. So the text that reads in between there is daring, sensible, severe, long and silky, boyish, ageless, silly, magnetic, country, fresh, and sweet, which is completely lifted out of ads in terms of hair products for women or feminine hygiene products for women. As this way of having all these different hairstyles, but in that, in all these stereotypes, was that, excuse me, what I was trying to convey is that nothing is known, that the subject or who that subject is or the person behind the photo on the other side of the gaze is never known, and that there is this lack of knowing. And I enjoy that even to this day in terms of my understanding of photography and our nature to infuse it with narratives or infuse it with some kind of empathy and understanding that we know the person that's pictured. But at the end of the day, I really believe, no, you do not know who that person is, but you can maybe understand yourself is what that's about. But that the kind of actual idea of understanding who that person is that's pictured is false. So, and I'm jumping because there are kind of bodies of work here, and I'm old, so, you know, there's a lot of work that I have to come. So we can have questions at the end, compress this. But in doing these photographic works that examine this idea of the viewer's relationship to photography and their desire to understand the subject and their desire to separate authorship from the subject as though it's this kind of... objective point of view that you can have this understanding was something that I was after for at least 7 or 8 years in my work. And there was a point at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago that I realized that in a survey show there and seeing all of this kind of studio work that was very dedicated and went down all these different avenues that it was disturbing because I walked into this exhibition in terms of like even being here and like hanging work and walking through the show before the opening. And I was like, oh my God, I can't do this work anymore. Only because I felt like I really had mined every idea that I had had. Not because I felt like I needed just to switch up for no reason, but that even in myself, I felt like, wow, you really need to switch gears here. And challenge yourself as an artist. So in that, this piece came to bear, which is called Wigs. And this is actually a version of it that extended into 2006. But then I set for myself, after doing these photographs with the figure with its back turned to the audience, kind of very starkly with text, to this as a surrogate. So I forbid myself the figure, which I will then, of course, as you will see in the exhibition here, quickly return to many years later. But in the intervening years, I thought to myself, I want to kind of examine in a way that I can talk about the same subjecthood without having the figure displayed or using the same formula, in a way, in the work. And Wigs becomes that. I go on to Fulton Avenue in Brooklyn, and I go to all these different wig shops, which it's changed now, but there were 90 million wig shops within a two-block period, and bought the most different wigs that I could find from different shops, and then took them back to my house, pinned them on the wall, and photographed them. And then they get silkscreened onto felt panels. Because I was also trying to change up the way that I worked in terms of photography. There's nothing more boring than, okay, so you have a photograph, you get it printed, you go to the lab, and then you got to get it mounted, and then you got to get it framed, and then you get, you know. And in some ways, I wanted to change up the kind of even my experience technically, but also the viewer's experience in terms of the way that they perceive this work and the way that they saw it. So to print on felt, they became kind of like drawings, which was interesting to me and had this very textural feeling and texture to them that from a distance they'd be very sharp, but as you come up close to them, they get kind of blurry and the kind of fabric or the fibers of felt would kind of start to break the image apart. So Wigs is really about gender and sexuality and this kind of gray area about, how, as a society, how we try to so much define and regulate how we think about gender and sexuality and all the forces since the turn of the century and people's activities that fight against that was kind of what Wigs was about. and then kind of picturing all these different appearances through these wigs. So working on felt, and I guess, I mean, I hate talking about my work in any kind of technical sense, purely, but that I see in kind of even moving into this show and moving into different mediums that I do really love and love being unsure of myself as an artist. I love being challenged by a particular medium or working in video or working in doing collages or now painting and not knowing, not having the assurity that, like, this is going to work, this is going to be good, and people are going to love this. Most often in the work, there becomes these periods of time that I am quite unsure of what I am doing, but I feel that I really do enjoy that kind of tension, and what happens in that space becomes, for me, magical. Not to say it's magical for the audience, but it's certainly magical for me. So in working in felt, this is from a series called Public Sex, which had images that I kind of, as a photographer, as someone who would a lot of traveling for exhibitions all over the world, in a way, I would always take, and I'm talking maybe now 10 or 15 years ago, I would take a Hasselblad camera with me everywhere that I went to force me to take pictures. Because as a photographer, kind of, if you have an instant camera, you kind of don't use it. If you have to go through security and beg for permission to have your film not go through X-ray and all of that, you kind of end up taking pictures just because of the effort that you have to make from going from point A to point B. And in that, I have this huge archive in the studio of all these pictures that I would take for just no reason. Like, I'd just be out and I would go, okay, so I'm out, I'm in Athens, or I'm in Italy, or I'm here, or I'm there, or I'm in South Africa, and I just want to take pictures. And reading Pat Calafia's book on public sex, which is this kind of historical and anecdotal way of talking about the activity of the historical activity of people in terms of the way that they access public space in terms of having sex, but also how that changes these spaces, how it changes from day to night or a certain day of the week or a certain area shifts. It's one thing during a certain hour and then another at another hour. And I was in New Mexico, and I just realized, oh my God, I have like all these photographs that are unpopulated. Maybe there's something in that. And so it was this mining of my own material that brought that work, you know, work that had been made maybe 5 or 6 years before that I used as a basis for the public sex series. So this was like on a trip with a boyfriend in Tuscany 5 years ago, but then kind of ended up being the subject of a work on public sex. And so as an artist, the idea of the archive, whether it's an archive that I, which I'll talk about later, that I find online or through kind of different other kind of archives or my own archive, seems to be this thing that becomes the fountain of ideas, the wellspring of how I work. So this is called The Car. And the text panel, which I don't think is included. Oh, it is. The text panel kind of talks about these couple arguing and the sounds and the cacophony of being in this kind of vaulted space in Italy and them having sex and kind of arguing, but the sounds it might create. So the piece isn't so much about having sex, but the negotiation of space and negotiation between people. This is Cloud. And this is at the House de Kuhn. So just to give you an idea of scale and size of these felt pieces. So let me put it, let me go back. Because, you know, PowerPoint is a nightmare. And, like, I've had the benefit of such an amazing crew here that they know how to figure it out. And, like, it plays instantly, and I kind of got to get used to, oh, I got to speak about that before I play it. So, easy to remember, I had an opportunity, which is not the first video project that I did, but in going to undergraduate school and studying film, I think my approach to photography was very much framed by studying film and framed by not taking for granted the structure in which photography works, but also really interested in the structure in terms of the way film works. So the opportunity, any opportunity that I could get at a certain point, I mean, I went to graduate school during analog period, which was just like, I will never, ever work in film, ever, because if I have to edit video, analog, I will die. And I will not make any work. I will just, it was so insane to me even then, and I had no idea that the digital age was going to come shortly thereafter, but it was just crazy. I was like, I got to hire somebody to do this. There's no way that I am going to negotiate this craziness. And also, seeing the work of Jean-Pierre Goran, and everybody was working in 16-millimeter film and editing on Steinbeck's, I was just like, really? Really, guys? And maybe because I was of a slightly younger generation, I was just like, this is fucking crazy. How can you keep track of all of this? But also the slow mechanism in terms of editing and thinking about image making is important, and that, the facility that we have in terms of editing digitally is not everything that it should be, because it kind of falls into another category of the facility of being able to do so, right? So it's one thing or another. But that said, easy to remember, shot in Columbus, Ohio. I grew up very much influenced by jazz, very influenced by my parents in terms of who were not New Yorkers, who took me to... they moved to New York in order to be able to enjoy the culture of New York, which meant theater, dance, art, visual art, going to museums, and I was dragged everywhere. Even dragged, I don't know, maybe I was like 7 or 6 years old, to Hair. Imagine seeing Hair as a six-year-old. And I know those of you who are laughing knows what I'm talking about. When everyone was naked on stage, I was like... Oh my God. I was looking at my parents like, really? This is a night out? But that said, it was a really, that was particularly, memorable for me. But they made me into the person that I am. And I think, when we think about art education now and young people, that is really, really hugely important that we remember that it's important to immerse young people in art as young children. They don't need to understand. You think I understood what the hell, Hair was about, or Since We Bonzi Is Dead by Anthel Fagard when I saw my parents? No, but there were bits and parts of things that I understood. And I think that misunderstanding, or not being able to understand the full picture, was something that fueled my interest in terms of art, that fueled this interest that I knew that I didn't understand what was going on, but that it was something bigger than me, that I had an interest at, that you can make up stuff. So for me, it was this idea that at a moment you could realize they just made up the name of that car. That car, the name of that car doesn't make any sense. Somebody made that up. And therefore, you can make up anything that you want. You can make anything that you want. And I think when we think of children and we think of young people in terms of education, it is the idea for them to understand that a lot of what we see is invented by individuals who had the audacity to do so in a good way. And that can be in a good and a bad way, of course. But that for them to actually understand that is really important. So all that said, I will play now. Easy to remember. Easy to remember, I think. Did I mess it up? Okay. No. He didn't have to do it, he did it. Mm-hmm. talk over this. So, I mean, what I did in Columbus was get 12 people to hum for me John Coltrane playing Easy to Remember, which is a Rodgers and Hart song. And it was interesting because the way that John Coltrane's ballad is interpreted, it kind of takes all these different directions. So it was very, it took a minute for everyone who was asked to participate to find their octave, to find what key they were going to take and how they were going to kind of flow through this. And there was one woman that we were working with, and while we were working with her, the sound person, which they do from time to time, call out like, okay, there's a truck going by, we've got to stop, or there's an airplane going by, like there's all this ambient sound that sometimes gets into the sound studio that isn't audible to everyone else. And he called me over, which I was just like, I don't hear anything. I was just like, oh my God, is the DAT machine broken? Oh God, you know, I was like cringing talking to him. He said, no, her heartbeat is louder than her humming. And I was like, okay, let's stop. And like we talked to her, because it is, you know, like you see this kind of thing and it's, you know, we have a camera, like a fairly large lens, and there are like 10 people and standing before you. And when you have people who aren't used to having an entire crew, they sign up to do this thing, but they think it's going to be intimate and it's not. And it becomes kind of nerve-wracking. And so all these different voices kind of get edited into one project that have all these different octaves. But it was an interesting project in terms of using this music that I found to be very comforting and being part of my childhood as a way to kind of play with music and to play with reinterpretation of John Coltrane's rendition of Easy to Remember. So it it gets to a point, I mean, I think graduate school really did, although I couldn't stand working in analog, I was waiting for that moment of digital. I was just waiting. And the moment that digital arrived, I was there. Although it drove me crazy because then the platforms changed completely. After the next 5 years, it was a nightmare in terms of adjusting to high definition, what's not high definition, like all the different varying things. But then comes Corridor. And Corridor kind of happens by accident in that I'm working on a project with, the project is for Mass Mocha, and they are working with ESPN, or I'm sorry, the Society for the Preservation of New England Antiquities. And what it basically is a warehouse of New England artifacts from 1600s till about to about the turn of the century, which I worked at the New York Historical Society and in the wintertime in Yonkers, New York, and there was nothing more challenging than being in the cold and categorizing cannonballs. And I mean, it's amazing, but you do, like, you lose your mind a bit, like, they would never miss, we could steal this shit, they would never miss it. They would never miss these photographs. They would never miss this cannonball. You know, we didn't steal anything. It was, you know, that would have taken too much of an effort. And like, you just say that when you're cold and you hadn't had lunch yet. But I had experienced, like, you know, the amazing thing of early American history in New York. So to go to New England and freezing, and then go to England and go to warehouses, so I was like, oh, this is really not me. I can't make a show in 2,000 square feet of just looking at objects. So I was going to pull out of the exhibition, and I was on the phone with them. I was like, you know, and my father had died. I was like, this really isn't me. I can't do this. I'm grieving. I don't have any interest in this. And they said, but please look at the book one more time. So I look at the book, and I'm like, but you have architecture. How interesting. And I go, well, can I use the Gropius house? And so the house on the, or the frame on the right is Walter Gropius's home, in, who's an amazing architect, who moved to the United States in the 40s after World War II. And it's like it's in Walden Pond. And it is preserved, although it's, I think, built in maybe 49 is its finished date. It looks like 1968. And I look at the pictures and I go, they have the same washcloths that my parents had in my house in 1968. It's 68, it's not 49. So the house, you know, like, you know, the longevity in terms of when it stops in its preservation is really, to me, 68. And I propose this idea because I live in Brooklyn in a 1860s house, and, you know, that's been gutted before I even bought it. And this kind of curious thing that you realize, you know, like there's a house or there's a church around the corner from me that is part of the Underground Railroad. So clearly, in my mind, yes, there are runaway slaves that are part of this community, that are in this community, and I'm living in this house now. And there is this dichotomy or these two different centuries of then and now. So I go, wouldn't it be interesting to do a project that, like, you know, this 1860s, just before emancipation, and the 1960s? And I see that in this book. And of course, they say to me, well, you know, it's the person, it's our, those are the private properties that we have, but like, you can't film in them. And I go, okay, fine. And in our negotiation, they finally give me permission and I get to shoot. And this is Wageshi Mutu, who's an artist at that time and was just starting at the Studio Museum before having a show at the museum, but was trying to decide whether or not she was going to go back to London, and kind of her visa was up. And I, all the people that I work with in my work are friends. It's like, if I know you and you're standing there and I have a project that's ready, I will ask you, can you work with me? Like, it's not a far-flung thing. But I then asked her, are you interested before you kind of go back to Europe to do this project? And she did. So it is the Walter Gropius home on the right, and on the left is the Coffin House, which is actually 1600s, but because of American vernacular architecture and all that change that takes place, it ends up really being kind of 1860s. And it's just the film kind of follows, or the video piece follows these two women from two different time spans, played by Wageshi Mutu, from day to night. And it's called Corridor. So these are the stills, and this is Corridor. I'll play part of it. The soundtrack is Blind Tom, who is a slave who also is an amazing composer and pianist during this time and dies as a slave. And Nurit Tillis plays some of his compositions. And it's, what's the word I want? I mix into that Albert Eiler, because for me, Albert Eiler as a jazz composer, there's a lot of similarities in the way that their work echoes this kind of American music. In a coffin house. There wasn't that much going on in a coffin house. mother was American and from Chicago. So the idea of kind of a black woman living in a modernist house in the late 60s was not something that I was unfamiliar with, given my history in Chicago. And so it's this play between these two actions of one of a woman who is going through the, you know, on the right in the coffin house, daily activities, and what geishi also playing in the coffin house, a kind of this modern life, say, as an independent woman. Because I want to talk a little bit. Thank you. So in terms of this piece, I mean, in thinking about the way that what happens, like narrative, I think I'm very much influenced by Jean Dielman, by Chantal Ackerman, and kind of seeing that film, which is very much a heightened narrative about violence and betrayal and murder, but that it kind of gets played out on this very mundane day-to-day level of how this woman's world is collapsing and why it's collapsing, but on in the minutia of her day-to-day. And I've always found it's always very interesting to me as an artist to explore the minutia rather than the larger, bigger thing, but the details of the day-to-day. So Corridor, I feel, is very much in keeping, although a completely different kind of narrative, thinking about Chantal Ackerman and kind of this, you know, like she has a character, the female character is peeling a potato in real time in that film, which is, it's almost, it's mesmerizing to watch, and it's also arresting to watch her go through these kind of different moments of her personal life in real, quote-unquote, real time, and not compressed in this kind of cut to the next shot and condensed sense of time, which I kind of do in here a bit, but there's still the minutia that exists. What else can I say about Corridor? And so the one in the Gropius house is kind of independent, doing her thing, and it's about a conversation on a telephone and waiting for someone to arrive. And the other one is an indentured servant. But I think for me, and much in the time that we're living in now, what was she thinking about the time that she's living in? Or what do we think about the minutia and how, kind of how we make our day-to-day? I know this is kind of in a moment that's probably much more obvious in terms of what we might be thinking, not so much collectively, but just even individually about the time we're living in now. But that corridor is kind of these two different points in time and thinking about the politics of the time these women are living in. So I'm not going to show all of that. To jump to, can I put this on pause? How do I put this on pause? This is Cloudscape, and it's Terry Atkins, who's a dear friend of mine who died a couple of years ago, or so, 3 years ago. Artist, musician, and educator. And we collaborated on this piece called Cloudscape. And in keeping with Easy to Remember, which I can never remember the name of that piece. I don't know why. It strikes me every time I can't remember the name of the piece. But that I wanted to do another piece that had to do with the body and making of music, and not in that humming was part of the thing of Easy to Remember, that Cloudscape is about the body again and whistling. And so Terry and I went through, which I can't read music anymore, kind of learned how to do it in terms of playing the violin, and like you don't use it, you lose it, right? So we went through these volumes of African-American hymns that are kind of from spirituals that were just music sheets from the Tuskegee Institute. And we chose one that's kind of familiar, but not too familiar, that was a little oblique, and chose a phrase in there that could be easily repeated and reversed. And what comes out of that is Cloudscape. Oops. I'm ready to play. Thank you. So as you can see, the piece kind of reverses itself. The whistling and the footage, everything goes into reverse and becomes a different tune. And becomes even, I mean, again, the people I collaborate with are people in my sphere. I mean, Terry's daughter was born the same year as mine. Our daughters were our friends since they were 2 years old. And I seem to gravitate to people that are just my circle, my friends, and people. And this piece becomes even more poignant because of his death, but then this thing of absence and return and reversal becomes even more poignant, in particular for Cloudscape. So then I do this other piece, and I'm going to try to speak more quickly through work, but and cut a little bit through more of the videos, called 1957-2009, made in 2009, which is based on some photographic images that I found online on eBay. And one of the images was of this woman leaning up against a car. And I thought, oh my God, that's amazing. And then I buy the image, and the seller says to me, well, I have about 250 images of her, like, posing. Are you interested? And I said, absolutely. And I buy them, and I get them, and I pin them up in my studio, and it's like, what the hell do I do with this? Because this is some, you know, pre-Cindy Sherman, working it out in Los Angeles, black woman thing that I have never seen before. And I do that, and I realize this is really incredible. And this is me posing as her. Like, so that's her. That's me. Don't laugh. Because it's like 300 photographs. You like, if you see them all together, you can't tell the difference between me and her. Like this, it's a little bit more explicit. Like, who's that? I understand. But when they're all together, it makes more sense. That's me posing as the guy. And what's interesting about it became this thing of expanding this project of this woman who is anonymous to me. I don't know who she is. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, photo album of family pictures and history. It's a project of performing in front of the camera between her and this man. And he is like the artist, and of course she's the muse, and he's, you know, the photographer, or more serious and intellectual. She's, you know, the pinup, the beauty, etc. And I then insert myself. I decided, okay, and something that I never did in the work before, which was really painful to me, wouldn't it be amazing to just expand their project by pretending to be both of them, expanding their gestures as much as you can. And I did that, and that was so painful, and I hated my family for helping me, and I was a nightmare. But it was a good project. And so, like, this is my piano at home. I was sitting on top of the piano. That's her. Two different body types and ways of... she's double jointed and longer limbed and younger. I mean, it was just insane. And it just, like, if someone's telling you assume different kinds of yoga positions for the camera, that's what it felt like. But it turned into, I mean, take that out of it, this kind of insertion of myself in this kind of posing for the camera and assertion about beauty and performance that is what I was mimicking, because in some ways I know nothing about her. I know nothing about her desire, nothing about who she is, nothing about all the, other than coming from Los Angeles and the particular 1957 being that really critical time period in terms of visibility, of having that kind of desire was something that was striking to me. But to insert myself seemed really interesting, because when you look, I mean, in going back, I'm sorry, I'm just going to go back for a second. There's a lot of photographs. So you don't quite see that it's not, that the differences between us as you're looking at them. Because in the nature of this kind of amateur photography, there's a lot of repetition of poses. There's a lot of repetition of shots that are part of the original set. So to insert more expands it, but you don't notice that I'm in it in a particular way, which makes it really kind of beautiful for me as a project. And so with that, in doing that project, which is like some 300-odd photographs at the end of it, I thought to myself, you know, but I really love the chess pictures of them. And I grew up with a dad who tried to teach me chess, and I was just like, I don't understand. Like, I never learned, you know. Even to this day, I was like, I can appreciate it. I understand Bobby Fischer. I get it. But I don't understand. Like, I don't have the patience for the game as a person. But I wanted to do a film project or do something else with this project from these 1957 images that had to do with the chess. I guess because of my own personal experience and relationship of my dad with chess for some reason. But I just thought it was interesting. So this thing of photography, right? And this is like a turn. This is from my own personal collection of photography. That's a cyanotype of this woman. You know, it's the kind of doubling of photography and the kind of trick photography of the turn of the century, which got me thinking about how to make this. Because in 1957, I am mirroring them. And they are mirroring a desire that they have for the way that they might be pictured in a larger circumstance of film or ads or photography or in terms of imagery. And every curator, every casual conversation I had with someone, they were like, yeah, but what about the Duchamp photograph of that five-way portrait? And I was like, oh, God, please, no. Well, what about Picabia's photograph? Like, Picabia and Duchamp are photographed by the same photographer who took this, which is in New York in 1911. Nobody knows who the photographer is, but he was photographing the shit out of every artist. Everybody was walking into his studio. So there's one curator that whose name I forget now. It was in the studio, and there's an artist who's showing at the Museum of Modern Art and using their collection. And she goes, yeah, but I know, yeah, the Duchamp image. And I'm like, yeah, everybody's told me about I know the Duchamp image, you know. Like, I too went to graduate school. I understand. And she goes, but have you seen this? And she pulls it up on her phone, this image, which is a black man in the position of Duchamp and Picabia. And I was like, okay, I give up. Okay, I'm going to use this. Now that you show me there's a black man with a kind of straw hat on that was in the same studio, so I was like, okay, maybe this is like a message from the universe. Just let it go and use this. And it made sense. It did make sense. I just didn't want to go with the first suggestions, just out of being, you know, a snob. But the beauty of this is that it's just a 45-degree mirror, and what it does is set up all the, you know, rather than have this Hitchcock infinity kind of multitude of images that happens, that into infinity, what happens is that you have these slight variations, and that's what makes it kind of a little disturbing to look at, because you go, but it looks like the same person, but they're all kind of in the same physical space. So I use that as my thing, and I shoot in my studio. We get. You know, reflective plexiglass at that 40-degree angle, and we shoot this piece called Chess. And the woman who's to the right, that's me in the center, and I'm made up looking like a man. And the funny thing is, like, you know, my mother's side of the family is from Chicago. My father is from Cuba and Jamaica. And all the people doing my hair and makeup are from Jamaica. So any of you who are Jamaican understand that if you start to look like the person who's dead, everybody freaks out. So they finish making me up, and I walk into the bathroom, and I go, wow, I look like my father. And I pull up the picture that's, like, stuck in my studio behind things, which is, like, the memorial picture, like a big, giant picture of him from his funeral probably 10 years earlier. And I go, look, guys, it really does look like him. And they're like, okay, put that shit away. You're conjuring your father. This is enough just to get through the shoot. We have a whole day here. Like, everyone was very freaked out by that. But I did look just like my father, which psychologically in a Freudian way is quite telling. It's a lot in that. Okay, that's a different thing. But for me, it was this interesting thing about gender and my perception of myself and kind of this transformation. But I really did not expect, although I know I look more like my father than I do my mother, that I would just really end up just looking just like mine. I mean, as a woman in this piece, in the way that I look like fucking Tina Turner. I don't look like my mother. But as the male character, I look like my father, which is just like, it's just very strange. So I had a chess wrangler, you know, kind of make all these moves in terms of the chess pieces, and it's an actual game that gets played out. It's also a collaboration with another friend, which is Jason Moran, who's a pianist and composer as well. And he comes to the studio, and we put him in the same position. We have a piano delivered to the studio, and we place it in the same way with the mirror so that there's this five-part reflection of him. So we'll, and some excerpts from Chess. But it was a way to kind of finish off. You know, sometimes as an artist, as you're working on something or a particular set of ideas, you're not done, and kind of chess closes out that set of found images that I found. So the characters in this, this is the male character, and the female character age as they are playing chess. So I don't know if I'm going to, I think I'm going to skip so that I have a little bit of time to kind of go through a little bit of the work. But what it does is that they age during the course of it, they play this game, and then it dissipates. But it was a way for me to play with this idea with, like, how do you use the most boring, you know, that's the forbidden thing. You don't place clocks in films, and you certainly don't have people playing chess in film. So at least to give you a little sense of, I'll at least let it play to have a little bit of sense of Jason's composition that's part of this. So in collaborating with Jason, I asked that he kind of mirror his hands, since all of this is about mirroring, that the composition reflect that. And he based it a little bit on kind of box exercises for the hands that get you to strengthen both hands in terms of playing the piano. And then it kind of evolves from that, from there. All plays in the same room, but I'm going to jump now. So part of the thing that I've been doing that brings us to the paintings is this idea of collage and working in collages for the past 5 years as a way and making little drawings, maybe now, maybe, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago now. But these are different collage pieces that I had worked on, I guess, from 2013, 2014, from based on Ebony magazine and just different source images from AP magazines and mineral mineral kind of books about gemstones and minerals and combining into that different faces, which are just out of wig ads, not so much celebrity or editorial, but wig ads out of Ebony magazine as part of that. So that kind of really led to working in the painting. The thing of doing, I mean, I'm kind of skipping over a body of work that was just really drawings, but that I feel that working in collage really fostered this kind of different sense of imagination. I mean, it was a lot of what I did, and I'm sure in artists in the room, you understand the process of working in film. It's a whole different thing in terms of time and pace and collaboration. But to be in the studio and just kind of make something very quickly that's completely intuitive, almost blindly, in a way of choosing images and pasting images and not having to quite make sense of them, which makes them very difficult to talk about, but interesting to make and kind of very freeing on a certain level. So for me, these works kind of represented a shift in the work, but a kind of much more fluid way in terms of my imagination, or a kind of release in terms of my own a kind of emotional life or emotional sense of the work that I had not experienced before. So, do these, which will shortly, this was, we turned into an animation, which we don't have, because that will take time, but the eyes blink, which is very disturbing. to Venice, and an exhibition in Venice, curated by Oakley and Wazor, 2 years ago, which I just decided, okay, you know, Glenn Ligon is a great friend of mine. Mark is also one who is amazing painting here in the museum. And being really embarrassed by being with other friends who are painters, they're like, really? You're going to start painting now? Like, really? And I'm like, who should I call to like make the basis for that? Who should I call for like, you know, panels? And just said, and the opportunity of making a proposal for Oakley and Wazor was just like, okay, I just said, forget it. I'm just going to try this and let's just see what happens. And I'm just going to walk out on that plank. And if it's like a huge failure, that's what it's going to be. And it was actually not a huge failure in terms of the works. And made these kind of paintings for the first time because I hadn't painted really since I was in undergraduate school. And so it was a very interesting experience for me because who knew painting is so physical? I had no idea. I mean, I lost weight. I became real. I mean, I work out, but it was just like I'd be exhausted any day. And I was going, guys, I didn't know painting was so physical. And they were like, yeah. And people were like, yeah, painting is. But also that I would kind of use collages and use all this other work as the basis to kind of create these images. And as a way to kind of unleash my own imagination and emotional life in a way into the work that I hadn't experienced before. Not so much that the more conceptual work wasn't emotional, but in the making of it, like the idea of it would be formed, and then you kind of execute. Whereas in the painting, it seems like it all gets done all at once, and it's even now, like a blur to me, like I turn around and go, how the hell did I do that? Like, how did that come into being? So for me, it seems kind of somewhat magical in a way, the way muscle memory and making marks operates in making work. But then using content to the work that's very specific in terms of borrowed or appropriated imagery. So this is kind of work from this fall. So yeah, I can't talk about it, so I'm just going to show it because it's like too new. Sorry. too new. And this is some of the work that's in the show that is about to happen here. And so it's interesting for me as an artist to kind of be able to straddle all these different arenas. But I would say, in terms of the content of the work, it's important to kind of, process is really important to me, and less that it comes out or that it's successful. Because certainly one cannot judge, or I am not an artist who can judge what is going to be successful or not on any level. It's only if the work satisfies me in terms of its process. And that's it. So I know that's really long-winded. but I am happy, or we are happy, to entertain any questions that anyone might have. Yes?
I got you.
Well, actually, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go right ahead. Allison's
going to Yeah.
Good evening, Lorna. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Good evening. I look at the diversity of your work as you go from one medium to another, What types of things change your mind or spur your interest to go in a different direction? Is it day to day, or is it just life experiences?
What inspires me to shift mediums?
Yes.
I mean, I think because I'm so heavily educated in the arts to a overly so, that I am aware of all these. I mean, in terms of art history or in terms of even technical knowledge, that I have the ability to do these things. But the ability is only fulfilled by an idea. So it wasn't my desire to work in film. It's literally like taking drugs. Like, directing is like a drug to me. So the first time, and I say this is about process. So the first time that I did that, I had a girlfriend of mine who at the time was working in film doing costume. And we went down to Columbus, Ohio. And we shot the first day. You know, we're staying in, you know, saving money. We're staying in the same hotel room. I get up at 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm going, oh my God, is it time to start for, you know, like, is it 5 o'clock? We have to go for the next shoot. And she's like, can you please go back to bed? It's only 1 o'clock in the morning. And I realize that it's such a drug for me, that there's something about the process and all these different mediums. Like, I am very attracted to working in a particular way, and that particularly film. It's like a high. Like, I go insane working in film. And that's important. So the departure is about the process, and that there's something that's really fulfilling for me, and that I disregard that I need to be active in only one particular way, but then that I am driven, literally driven, to work in different kinds of ways. Thank you. Yes.
First of all, this one's on. First of all, I want to thank you. I'm so inspired by your work, and my students especially are inspired by your work. And that's kind of my question. As a high school art teacher and a high school art history teacher,
yeah.
Can you kind of talk about your experience in the arts at the high school level?
Well, I am unusual because I went to the High School of Art and Design in New York. And in the 70s. So, I mean, I think because I couldn't think of anything else to do, like, you know, are you going to go to, I don't know, study math and science at, you know, any of the math and science schools in Brooklyn? And I chose art. But I would say that it was amazing, and that although, you know, one could say, oh, well, that's a very kind of insular education, I think in some ways, besides, you know, going to clubs and Studio 54 and all the things that we did in Midtown Manhattan that we had access to, that children and young people, regardless if they're going to become, it's not about becoming artists per se, but that it's the idea of creativity. And that the broadness of thinking about trying to put your mindset or look at how someone else came up with something creatively, and that basically they just brought something into fruition out of their head, I think is really important, whether you're interested in math or science or business or writing, that those things are really important. And that now, in terms of education, and I try to work within the studio to have young people in terms of elementary school to high school come to the studio, and we just talk about creativity, is really important, because that was so much a part of my education. I think in the 70s, the public education still afforded violin and dance and a band and all these different kinds of things in terms of thinking about art in its multiplicity of ways of creating things. And I studied dance. I mean, I spent so much time in that now when I think of young people and young children, they don't have that opportunity. And so not that everyone becomes quote-unquote artists. That's not the goal, but how they think of their own brain. It allows you to understand how your brain works, how your idea of creativity and imagination works, and that can be applied to anything. So I applaud you for the work that you do, and that how important that is, that even though there might not be, you know, I mean, there's a lot of non-for-profits that are in place to try to promote the education of young people in terms of the arts, but that it is really on the teachers and public school that have to take it on independently to create that sense of here's the world that is possible, and here's a way of the lens in which you can look at the way what you might want to become or what you might want to do in the world. So yeah, I think it's hugely, hugely important.
Well, if there aren't any more questions, that was such a beautiful job. Thank you so, so much.